In history, power stems only partially from knowing the truth. It also stems from the ability to maintain social order among a large number of people. Suppose you want to make an atom bomb. To succeed, you obviously need some accurate knowledge of physics. But you also need lots of people to mine uranium ore, build nuclear reactors, and provide food for the construction workers, miners, and physicists. The Manhattan Project directly employed about 130,000 people, with millions more working to sustain them. Robert Oppenheimer could devote himself to his equations because he relied on thousands of miners to extract uranium at the El Dorado mine in northern Canada and the Shinkolobwe mine in the Belgian Congo, not to mention the farmers who grew potatoes for his lunch. If you want to make an atom bomb, you must find a way to make millions of people cooperate. It is the same with all ambitious projects that humans undertake. A Stone Age band going to hunt a mammoth obviously needed to know some facts about mammoths. If they believed they could kill a mammoth by casting spells, their hunting expedition would have failed. But knowing facts about mammoths wasn't enough. The hunters also needed to risk death and show great courage. If they believed that a certain spell guaranteed a good afterlife for dead hunters, their hunting expeditions had a much higher chance of success. Even if the spell did not benefit dead hunters in any way, by fortifying the courage and solidarity of living hunters, it made a crucial contribution to the hunt's success. If you build a bomb and ignore the facts of physics, the bomb will not explode. But if you build an ideology and ignore the facts, the ideology may still prove explosive. While power depends on both truth and order, it is usually the people who know how to build ideologies and maintain order who give instructions to the people who merely know how to build bombs or hunt mammoths. Robert Oppenheimer obeyed Franklin Delano Roosevelt rather than the other way around. Similarly, Werner Heisenberg obeyed Adolf Hitler, Igor Kurchatov deferred to Joseph Stalin, and in contemporary Iran, experts in nuclear physics follow the orders of experts in Shiite theology. What the people at the top know, which nuclear physicists don't always realize, is that telling the truth about the universe is hardly the most efficient way to produce order among large numbers of humans. It is true that E equals mc squared, and it explains a lot of what happens in the universe. But knowing that E equals mc squared usually doesn't resolve political disagreements or inspire people to make sacrifices for a common cause. Instead, what holds human networks together tends to be fictional stories, especially stories about intersubjective things like gods, money, and nations. When it comes to uniting people, fiction enjoys two inherent advantages over the truth. First, fiction can be made as simple as we like, whereas the truth tends to be complicated, because the reality it is supposed to represent is complicated. Take, for example, the truth about nations. It is difficult to grasp that the nation to which one belongs is an intersubjective entity that exists only in our collective imagination. You rarely hear politicians say such things in their political speeches. It is far easier to believe that our nation is God's chosen people, entrusted by the Creator with some special mission. This simple story has been repeatedly told by countless politicians from Israel to Iran and from the United States to Russia. Second, the truth is often painful and disturbing. And if we try to make it more comforting and flattering, it will no longer be the truth. In contrast, fiction is highly malleable. The history of every nation contains some dark episodes that citizens don't like to acknowledge and remember. An Israeli politician who in her election speeches details the miseries inflicted on Palestinian civilians by the Israeli occupation is unlikely to get many votes. In contrast, a politician who builds a national myth by ignoring uncomfortable facts, focusing on glorious moments in the Jewish past, and embellishing reality wherever necessary, may well sweep to power. That's the case not just in Israel, but in all countries. How many Italians or Indians want to hear the unblemished truth about their nations? An uncompromising adherence to the truth is essential for scientific progress, and it is also an admirable spiritual practice, but it is not a winning political strategy. Already in his Republic, Plato imagined that the constitution of his utopian state would be based on the noble lie, a fictional story about the origin of the social order, one that secures the citizens' loyalty and prevents them from questioning the constitution. Citizens should be told, Plato wrote, that they were all born out of the earth, that the land is their mother, and that they therefore owe filial loyalty to the motherland. They should further be told that when they were conceived, the gods intermingled different metals, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, into them, which justifies a natural hierarchy between golden rulers and bronze servants. While Plato's utopia was never realized in practice, numerous polities through the ages told their inhabitants variations of this noble lie. Plato's noble lie notwithstanding, we should not conclude that all politicians are liars or that all national histories are deceptions. The choice isn't simply between telling the truth and lying. There is a third option. Telling a fictional story is lying only when you pretend that the story is a true representation of reality. Telling a fictional story isn't lying when you avoid such pretense and acknowledge that you are trying to create a new intersubjective reality rather than represent a pre-existing objective reality. For example, on September 17, 1787, the Constitutional Convention signed the US Constitution, which came into force in 1789. The Constitution didn't reveal any pre-existing truth about the world, but crucially, it wasn't a lie either. Rejecting Plato's recommendation, the authors of the text didn't deceive anyone about the text's origins. They didn't pretend that the text came down from heaven or that it had been inspired by some god. Rather, they acknowledged that it was an extremely creative legal fiction generated by fallible human beings. "We, the people of the United States," says the Constitution about its own origins, "in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this Constitution." Despite the acknowledgement that it is a human-made legal fiction, the US Constitution indeed managed to form a powerful union. It has maintained for more than two centuries a surprising degree of order among many millions of people who belong to a wide range of religious, ethnic, and cultural groups. The US Constitution has thus functioned like a tune that, without claiming to represent anything, has nevertheless made numerous people act together in order. It is crucial to note that order should not be confused with fairness or justice. The order created and maintained by the US Constitution condoned slavery, the subordination of women, the expropriation of indigenous people, and extreme economic inequality. The genius of the US Constitution is that by acknowledging that it is a legal fiction created by human beings, it was able to provide mechanisms to reach agreement on amending itself and remedying its own injustices, as Chapter 5 explores in greater depth. The Constitution's Article 5 details how people can propose and ratify such amendments, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution. Less than a century after the Constitution was written, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. In this, the US Constitution was fundamentally different from stories that denied their fictive nature and claimed divine origin, such as the Ten Commandments. Like the US Constitution, the Ten Commandments endorsed slavery. The 10th commandment says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male slave or female slave." Exodus 20:17. This implies that God is perfectly okay with people holding slaves, and objects only to the coveting of slaves belonging to someone else. But unlike the US Constitution, the Ten Commandments failed to provide any amendment mechanism. There is no 11th commandment that says you can amend commandments by a two-thirds majority vote. This crucial difference between the two texts is clear from their opening gambits. The US Constitution opens with, "We the people." By acknowledging its human origin, it invests humans with the power to amend it. The Ten Commandments open with, "I am the Lord your God." By claiming divine origin, it precludes humans from changing it. As a result, the biblical text still endorses slavery even today. All human political systems are based on fictions, but some admit it and some do not. Being truthful about the origins of our social order makes it easier to make changes in it. If humans like us invented it, we can amend it. But such truthfulness comes at a price. Acknowledging the human origins of the social order makes it harder to persuade everyone to agree on it. If humans like us invented it, why should we accept it? As we shall see in chapter 5, until the late 18th century, the lack of mass communication technology made it extremely difficult to conduct open debates between millions of people about the rules of the social order. To maintain order, Russian Tsars, Muslim caliphs, and Chinese sons of heaven therefore claimed that the fundamental rules of society came down from heaven and were not open to human amendment. In the early 21st century, many political systems still claim superhuman authority and oppose open debates that may result in unwelcome changes. The perennial dilemma. After we understand the key role of fiction in history, it is finally possible to present a more complete model of information networks, which goes beyond both the naive view of information and the populist critique of that view. Contrary to the naive view, information isn't the raw material of truth, and human information networks aren't geared only to discover the truth. But contrary to the populist view, information isn't just a weapon either. Rather, to survive and flourish, every human information network needs to do two things simultaneously: discover truth and create order. Accordingly, as history unfolded, human information networks have been developing two distinct sets of skills. On the one hand, as the naive view expects, the networks have learned how to process information to gain a more accurate understanding of things like medicine, mammoths, and nuclear physics. At the same time, the networks have also learned how to use information to maintain stronger social order among larger populations, by using not just truthful accounts, but also fictions, fantasies, propaganda, and, occasionally, downright lies. Having a lot of information doesn't in and of itself guarantee either truth or order. It is a difficult process to use information to discover the truth and simultaneously use it to maintain order. What makes things worse is that these two processes are often contradictory, because it is frequently easier to maintain order through fictions. Sometimes, as in the case of the US Constitution, fictional stories may acknowledge their fictionality, but more often they disavow it. Religions, for example, always claim to be an objective and eternal truth rather than a fictional story invented by humans. In such cases, the search for truth threatens the foundations of the social order. Many societies require their populations not to know their true origins. Ignorance is strength. What happens then when people get uncomfortably close to the truth? What happens when the same bit of information reveals an important fact about the world and also undermines the noble lie that holds society together? In such cases, society may seek to preserve order by placing limits on the search for truth. One obvious example is Darwin's theory of evolution. Understanding evolution greatly advances our understanding of the origins and biology of species, including Homo sapiens, but it also undermines the central myths that maintain order in numerous societies. No wonder that various governments and churches have banned or limited the teaching of evolution, preferring to sacrifice truth for the sake of order. A related problem is that an information network may allow and even encourage people to search for truth, but only in specific fields that help generate power without threatening the social order. The result can be a very powerful network that is singularly lacking in wisdom. Nazi Germany, for example, cultivated many of the world's leading experts in chemistry, optics, engineering, and rocket science. It was largely Nazi rocket science that later took the Americans to the moon. This scientific prowess helped the Nazis build an extremely powerful war machine, which was then deployed in the service of a deranged and murderous mythology. Under Nazi rule, Germans were encouraged to develop rocket science, but they were not free to question racist theories about biology and history. That's a major reason why the history of human information networks isn't a triumphant march of progress. While over the generations, human networks have grown increasingly powerful, they have not necessarily grown increasingly wise. If a network privileges order over truth, it can become very powerful but use that power unwisely. Instead of a march of progress, the history of human information networks is a tightrope walk, trying to balance truth with order. In the 21st century, we aren't much better at finding the right balance than our ancestors were in the Stone Age. Contrary to what the mission statements of corporations like Google and Facebook imply, simply increasing the speed and efficiency of our information technology doesn't necessarily make the world a better place. It only makes the need to balance truth and order more urgent. The invention of the story taught us this lesson already tens of thousands of years ago. And the same lesson would be taught again when humans came up with their second great information technology, the written document. Chapter 3. Documents. The Bite of the Paper Tigers. Stories were the first crucial information technology developed by humans. They laid the foundation for all large-scale human cooperation and made humans the most powerful animals on Earth. But as an information technology, stories have their limitations. To appreciate this, consider the role storytelling plays in the formation of nations. Many nations have first been conceived in the imagination of poets. Sarah Aronson and the Neely Underground are remembered by present-day Israelis as some of the first Zionists who risked their lives in the 1910s to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. But from where did Neely members get this idea in the first place? They were inspired by an earlier generation of poets, thinkers, and visionaries such as Theodor Herzl and Chaim Nachman Bialik. In the 1890s and first decade of the 20th century, Bialik, a Ukrainian Jew, published numerous poems and stories bewailing the persecution and weakness of European Jews and calling on them to take their fate in their hands, to defend themselves by force of arms, immigrate to Palestine, and there establish their own state. One of his most stirring poems was written following the Kishinev pogrom of 1903, in which 49 Jews were murdered and dozens more were injured. In the City of Slaughter, condemned the murderous anti-Semitic mob who perpetrated the atrocities, but it also criticized the Jews themselves for their pacifism and helplessness. In one heart-wrenching scene, Bialik describes how Jewish women were gang-raped while their husbands and brothers hid nearby, afraid to intervene. The poem compares the Jewish men to terrified mice and imagines how they quietly prayed to God to perform some miracle, which failed to materialize. The poem then tells how even after the pogrom was over, the survivors had no thought of arming themselves, and instead entered Talmudic disputations about whether the raped women were now ritualistically defiled or whether they were still pure. This poem is mandatory reading in many Israeli schools today. It is also mandatory reading for anyone wishing to understand how, after 2 millennia of being one of the most pacifist groups in history, Jews built one of the most formidable armies in the world. Not for nothing was Bialik named Israel's national poet. The fact that Bialik lived in Ukraine and was intimately familiar with the persecution of Ashkenazi Jews in Eastern Europe, but had little understanding of conditions in Palestine, contributed to the subsequent conflict there between Jews and Arabs. Bialik's poems inspired Jews to see themselves as victims in dire need of developing their military might and building their own country, but hardly considered the catastrophic consequences for the Arab inhabitants of Palestine, or indeed for the Mizrahi Jewish communities native to the Middle East. When the Arab-Israeli conflict exploded in the late 1940s, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and hundreds of thousands of Mizrahi Jews were driven out of their ancestral homes in the Middle East, partly as a result of poems composed half a century earlier in Ukraine. While Bialik was writing in Ukraine, the Hungarian Jew, Theodor Herzl, was busy organizing the Zionist movement in the 1890s and early years of the 20th century. As a central part of his political activism, Herzl published 2 books. The Jewish State, 1896, was a manifesto outlining Herzl's idea of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine, and The Old New Land, 1902, was a utopian novel set in the year 1923, describing the prosperous Jewish state that Herzl envisioned. The 2 books, which fatefully also tended to ignore realities on the ground in Palestine, were immensely influential in shaping the Zionist movement. The Old New Land appeared in Hebrew under the title Tel Aviv, a loose Hebrew translation of Old New Land. The city of Tel Aviv, established 7 years after the book's publication, took its name from the book. While Bialik is Israel's national poet, Herzl is known as the visionary of the state. The yarns Bialik and Herzl wove ignored many crucial facts about contemporary reality, most notably that around 1900, the Jews of Palestine comprised only 6-9% of the region's total population of about 600,000 people. While disregarding such demographic facts, Bialik and Herzl accorded great importance to mythology, most notably the stories of the Bible, without which modern Zionism is unimaginable. Bialik and Herzl were also influenced by the nationalist myths that were created in the 19th century by almost every other ethnic group in Europe. The Ukrainian Jew Bialik and the Hungarian Jew Herzl did for Zionism what was earlier done by the poets Taras Shevchenko for Ukrainian nationalism, Sandor Petofi for Hungarian nationalism, and Adam Mickiewicz for Polish nationalism. Observing the growth of other national movements all around, Herzl wrote that nations arise out of dreams, songs, fantasies. But dreams, songs, and fantasies, however inspiring, are not enough to create a functioning nation-state. Bialik inspired generations of Jewish fighters, but to equip and maintain an army, it is also necessary to raise taxes and buy guns. Herzl's utopian book laid the foundations for the city of Tel Aviv. But to keep the city going, it was also necessary to dig a sewage system. When all is said and done, the essence of patriotism isn't reciting stirring poems about the beauty of the motherland, and it certainly isn't making hate-filled speeches against foreigners and minorities. Rather, patriotism means paying your taxes so that people on the other side of the country also enjoy the benefit of a sewage system, as well as security, education, and healthcare. To manage all these services and raise the necessary taxes, enormous amounts of information need to be collected, stored, and processed. Information about properties, payments, exemptions, discounts, debts, inventories, shipments, budgets, bills, and salaries. This, however, is not the kind of information that can be turned into a memorable poem or a captivating myth. Instead, tax records come in the shape of various types of lists, ranging from a simple item-by-item record to more elaborate tables and spreadsheets. No matter how intricate these datasets may become, they eschew narrative in favor of dryly listing amounts owed and amounts paid. Poets can afford to ignore such mundane facts, but tax collectors cannot. Lists are crucial not only for national taxation systems, but also for almost all other complex financial institutions. Corporations, banks, and stock markets cannot exist without them. A church, a university, or a library that wants to balance its budget soon realizes that in addition to priests and poets who can mesmerize people with stories, it needs accountants who know their way around the various types of lists. Lists and stories are complementary. National myths legitimize the tax records, while the tax records help transform aspirational stories into concrete schools and hospitals. Something analogous happens in the field of finance. The dollar, the pound sterling, and the Bitcoin are all brought into being by persuading people to believe a story. And tales told by bankers, finance ministers, and investment gurus raise or lower their value. When the chairperson of the Federal Reserve wants to curb inflation, when a finance minister wants to pass a new budget, and when a tech entrepreneur wants to draw investors, they all turn to storytelling. But to actually manage a bank, a budget, or a startup, lists are essential. The big problem with lists, and the crucial difference between lists and stories, is that lists tend to be far more boring than stories, which means that while we easily remember stories, we find it difficult to remember lists. This is an important fact about how the human brain processes information. Evolution has adapted our brains to be good at absorbing, retaining, and processing even very large quantities of information when they are shaped into a story. The Ramayana, one of the foundational tales of Hindu mythology, is 24,000 verses long and runs to about 1,700 pages in modern editions. Yet despite its enormous length, generations of Hindus succeeded in remembering and reciting it by heart. In the 20th and 21st centuries, the Ramayana was repeatedly adapted for film and television. In 1987-88, a 78-episode version, running to about 2,730 minutes, was the most watched television series in the world, with more than 650 million viewers. According to a BBC report, when episodes were aired, streets would be deserted, shops would be closed, and people would bathe and garland their TV sets. During the 2020 COVID-19 lockdown, the series was re-aired and again became the most watched show in the world. While modern TV audiences need not memorize any texts by heart, it is noteworthy how easy they find it to follow the intricate plots of epic dramas, detective thrillers, and soap operas, recalling who each character is and how they are related to numerous others. We are so accustomed to performing such feats of memory that we seldom consider how extraordinary they are. What makes us so good at remembering epic poems and long-running TV series is that long-term human memory is particularly adapted to retaining stories. As Kendall Haven writes in his 2007 book, Story Proof, The Science Behind the Startling Power of Story, human minds rely on stories and on story architecture as the primary roadmap for understanding, making sense of, remembering, and planning our lives. Lives are like stories because we think in story terms. Haven references more than 120 academic studies, concluding that research overwhelmingly, convincingly, and without opposition provides the evidence that stories are a highly efficient vehicle for communicating factual, conceptual, emotional, and tacit information. In contrast, most people find it hard to remember lists by heart, and few people would be interested in watching a TV recitation of India's tax records or annual budget. Mnemonic methods used to memorize lists of items often work by weaving the items into a plot, thereby turning the list into a story. But even with the help of such mnemonic devices, who could remember their country's tax records or budget? The information may be vital, determining what quality of healthcare, education, and welfare services citizens enjoy, but our brains are not adapted to remembering such things. Unlike national poems and myths, which can be stored in our brains, complex national taxation and administration systems have required a unique, non-organic information technology in order to function. This technology is the written document. To Kill Alone. The written document was invented many times in many places. Some of the earliest examples come from ancient Mesopotamia. A cuneiform clay tablet dated to the 28th day of the 10th month of the 41st year of the reign of King Shulgi of Ur, circa 2053-54 BCE, recorded the monthly deliveries of sheep and goats. 15 sheep were delivered on the second day of the month, 7 sheep on the third day, 11 sheep on the fourth, 219 on the fifth, 47 on the 6th, and so on until 3 sheep were delivered on the 28th. In total, says the clay tablet, 896 animals were received that month. Remembering all these deliveries was important for the royal administration to monitor people's obedience and to keep track of available resources. While doing so in one's head was a formidable challenge, it was easy for a learned scribe to write them down on a clay tablet. Like stories and like all other information technologies in history, written documents didn't necessarily represent reality accurately. The Ur tablet, for example, contained a mistake. The document says that 896 animals were received during that month. But when modern scholars added up all the individual entries, they reached a total of 898. The scribe who wrote the document apparently made a mistake when he calculated the overall tally, and the tablet preserved this mistake for posterity. But whether true or false, written documents created new realities. By recording lists of properties, taxes, and payments, they made it far easier to create administrative systems, kingdoms, religious organizations, and trade networks. More specifically, documents changed the method used for creating intersubjective realities. In oral cultures, intersubjective realities were created by telling a story that many people repeated with their mouths and remembered in their brains. Brain capacity consequently placed a limit on the kinds of intersubjective realities that humans created. Humans couldn't forge an intersubjective reality that their brains couldn't remember. This limit could be transcended, however, by writing documents. The documents didn't represent an objective empirical reality. The reality was the documents themselves. As we shall see in later chapters, written documents thereby provided precedents and models that would eventually be used by computers. The ability of computers to create intersubjective realities is an extension of the power of clay tablets and pieces of paper. As a key example, consider ownership. In oral communities that lacked written documents, ownership was an intersubjective reality created through the words and behaviors of the community members. To own a field meant that your neighbors agreed that this field was yours, and they behaved accordingly. They didn't build a hut on that field, graze their livestock there, or pick fruits there without first asking your permission. Ownership was created and maintained by people continuously saying or signaling things to one another. This made ownership the affair of a local community and placed a limit on the ability of a distant central authority to control all land ownership. No king, minister, or priest could remember who owned each field in hundreds of distant villages. This also placed a limit on the ability of individuals to claim and exercise absolute property rights, and instead favored various forms of communal property rights. For example, your neighbors might acknowledge your right to cultivate a field, but not your right to sell it to foreigners. In a literate state, to own a field increasingly came to mean that it is written on some clay tablet, bamboo strip, piece of paper, or silicon chip that you own that field. If your neighbors have been grazing their sheep for years on a piece of land, and none of them ever said that you own it, but you can somehow produce an official document that says it is yours, you have a good chance of enforcing your claim. Conversely, if all the neighbors agree that it is your field, but you don't have any official document that proves it, tough luck. Ownership is still an intersubjective reality created by exchanging information, but the information now takes the form of a written document or a computer file, rather than of people talking and gesturing to each other. This means that ownership can now be determined by a central authority that produces and holds the relevant documents. It also means that you can sell your field without asking your neighbor's permission, simply by transferring the crucial document to someone else. The power of documents to create intersubjective realities was beautifully manifested in the old Assyrian dialect, which treated documents as living things that could also be killed. Loan contracts were killed, duekum, when the debt was repaid. This was done by destroying the tablet, adding some mark to it, or breaking its seal. The loan contract didn't represent reality, it was the reality. If somebody repaid the loan but failed to kill the document, the debt was still owed. Conversely, if somebody didn't repay the loan but the document died in some other way, perhaps the dog ate it, the debt was no more. The same happens with money. If your dog eats a $100 bill, those $100 cease to exist. In Shulgi's Ur in ancient Assyria, and in numerous subsequent polities, social, economic, and political relations relied on documents that create reality instead of merely representing it. When writing constitutions, peace treaties, and commercial contracts, lawyers, politicians, and business people wrangle for weeks and even months over each word because they know that these pieces of paper can wield enormous power. Bureaucracy. Every new information technology has its unexpected bottlenecks. It solves some old problems, but creates new ones. In the early 1730s BCE, Naramtani, a priestess in the Mesopotamian city of Sippar, wrote a letter, on a clay tablet, to a relative, asking him to send her a few clay tablets he kept in his house. She explained that her claim to an inheritance was being contested and she couldn't prove her case in court without those documents. She ended her message with a plea, "Now, do not neglect me." We don't know what happened next. But just imagine the situation if the relative searched his house but could not find the missing tablets. As people produced more and more documents, finding them turned out to be far from easy. This was a particular challenge for kings, priests, merchants, and anyone else who accumulated thousands of documents in their archives. How do you find the right tax record, payment receipt, or business contract when you need it. Written documents were much better than human brains in recording certain types of information, but they created a new and very thorny problem: retrieval. The brain is remarkably efficient in retrieving whatever information is stored in its network of tens of billions of neurons and trillions of synapses. Though our brain archives countless complex stories about our personal life, our national history, and our religious mythology, healthy people can retrieve information about any of them in less than a second. What did you eat for breakfast? Who was your first crush? When did your country gain its independence? What's the first verse in the Bible? How did you retrieve all these pieces of information? What mechanism activates the right neurons and synapses to rapidly call up the necessary information? Though neuroscientists have made some progress in the study of memory, nobody yet understands what memories are or how exactly they are stored and retrieved. What we do know is that millions of years of evolution streamlined the brain's retrieval processes. However, once humans have outsourced memories from organic brains to inorganic documents, retrieval could no longer rely on that streamlined biological system. Nor could it rely on the foraging abilities that humans evolved over millions of years. Evolution has adapted humans for finding fruits and mushrooms in a forest, but not for finding documents in an archive. Foragers locate fruits and mushrooms in a forest because evolution has organized forests according to a discernible organic order. Fruit trees photosynthesize, so they require sunlight. Mushrooms feed on dead organic matter, which can usually be found in the ground. So mushrooms are usually down at soil level, whereas fruits grow farther up. Another common rule is that apples grow on apple trees, whereas figs grow on fig trees. So, if you're looking for an apple, you first need to locate an apple tree, and then look up. When living in a forest, humans learn this organic order. It is very different with archives. Since documents aren't organisms, they don't obey any biological laws, and evolution didn't organize them for us. Tax reports don't grow on a tax report shelf. They need to be placed there. For that, somebody first needs to come up with the idea of categorizing information by shelves and to decide which documents should go on which shelf. Unlike foragers, who need merely to discover the pre-existing order of the forest, archivists need to devise a new order for the world. That order is called bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is the way people in large organizations solved the retrieval problem and thereby created bigger and more powerful information networks. But like mythology, bureaucracy too tends to sacrifice truth for order. By inventing a new order and imposing it on the world, bureaucracy distorted people's understanding of the world in unique ways. Many of the problems of our 21st century information networks, like biased algorithms that mislabel people, or rigid protocols that ignore human needs and feelings, are not new problems of the computer age. They are quintessential bureaucratic problems that have existed long before anyone even dreamed of computers. Bureaucracy and the search for truth. Bureaucracy literally means rule by writing desk. The term was invented in 18th century France, when the typical official sat next to a writing desk with drawers, a bureau. At the heart of the bureaucratic order, then, is the drawer. Bureaucracy seeks to solve the retrieval problem by dividing the world into drawers and knowing which document goes into which drawer. The principle remains the same regardless of whether the document is placed into a drawer, a shelf, a basket, a jar, a computer folder, or any other receptacle. Divide and rule. Divide the world into containers and keep the containers separate so the documents don't get mixed up. This principle, however, comes with a price. Instead of focusing on understanding the world as it is, bureaucracy is often busy imposing a new and artificial order on the world. Bureaucrats begin by inventing various drawers, which are intersubjective realities that don't necessarily correspond to any objective divisions in the world. The bureaucrats then try to force the world to fit into these drawers, and if the fit isn't very good, the bureaucrats push harder. Anyone who ever filled out an official form knows this only too well. When you fill out the form and none of the listed options fits your circumstances, you must adapt yourself to the form, rather than the form adapting to you. Reducing the messiness of reality to a limited number of fixed drawers helps bureaucrats keep order, but it comes at the expense of truth. Because they are fixated on their drawers, even when reality is far more complex, bureaucrats often develop a distorted understanding of the world. The urge to divide reality into rigid drawers also leads bureaucrats to pursue narrow goals irrespective of the wider impact of their actions. A bureaucrat tasked with increasing industrial production is likely to ignore environmental considerations that fall outside her purview, and perhaps dump toxic waste into a nearby river, leading to an ecological disaster downstream. If the government then establishes a new department to combat pollution, its bureaucrats are likely to push for ever more stringent regulations, even if this results in economic ruin for communities upstream. Ideally, someone should be able to take into account all the different considerations and aspects, but such a holistic approach requires transcending or abolishing the bureaucratic division. The distortions created by bureaucracy affect not only government agencies and private corporations, but also scientific disciplines. Consider, for example, how universities are divided into different faculties and departments. History is separate from biology and from mathematics. Why? Certainly, this division doesn't reflect objective reality. It is the intersubjective invention of academic bureaucrats. The COVID-19 pandemic, for example, was at one and the same time a historical, biological, and mathematical event. But the academic study of pandemics is divided between the separate departments of history, biology, and mathematics, among others. Students pursuing an academic degree must usually decide to which of these departments they belong. Their decision limits their choice of courses, which in turn shapes their understanding of the world. Mathematics students learn how to predict future morbidity levels from present rates of infection. Biology students learn how viruses mutate over time. And history students learn how religious and political beliefs affect people's willingness to follow government instructions. To fully understand COVID-19 requires taking into account mathematical, biological, and historical phenomena. But academic bureaucracy doesn't encourage such a holistic approach. As you climb the academic ladder, the pressure to specialize only increases. The academic world is ruled by the law of publish or perish. If you want a job, you must publish in peer-reviewed journals. But journals are divided by discipline, and publishing an article on virus mutations in a biology journal demands following different conventions from publishing an article on the politics of pandemics in a history journal. There are different jargons, different citation rules, and different expectations. Historians should have a deep understanding of culture and know how to read and interpret historical documents. Biologists should have a deep understanding of evolution and know how to read and interpret DNA molecules. Things that fall in between categories, like the interplay between human political ideologies and virus evolution, are often left unaddressed. To appreciate how academics force a messy and fluid world into rigid bureaucratic categories, let's dig a little deeper in the specific discipline of biology. Before Darwin could explain the origin of species, earlier scholars like Carl Linnaeus first had to define what a species is and classify all living organisms into species. To argue that lions and tigers evolved from a common feline ancestor, you first have to define lions and tigers. This turned out to be a difficult and never-ending job, because animals, plants, and other organisms often trespass the boundaries of their allotted drawers. Evolution cannot be easily contained in any bureaucratic schema. The whole point of evolution is that species continually change, which means that putting each species in one unchanging drawer distorts biological reality. For example, it is an open question when Homo erectus ended and Homo sapiens began. Were there once two erectus parents whose child was the first sapiens? Species also keep intermingling, with animals belonging to seemingly separate species not only having sex, but even siring fertile offspring. Most sapiens living today have about 1-3% Neanderthal DNA, indicating that there once was a child whose father was a Neanderthal and whose mother was a sapiens, or vice versa. So, are sapiens and Neanderthals the same species or different species? And is species an objective reality that biologists discover, or is it an intersubjective reality that biologists impose? There are numerous other examples of animals breaking out of their drawers, so the neat bureaucratic division fails to accurately categorize ring species, fusion species, and hybrids. Grizzly bears and polar bears sometimes produce pizzly bears and grolar bears. Lions and tigers produce ligers and tigons. When we shift our attention from mammals and other multicellular organisms to the world of single-cell bacteria and archaea, we discover that anarchy reigns. In a process known as horizontal gene transfer, single-cell organisms routinely exchange genetic material not only with organisms from related species, but also with organisms from entirely different genera, kingdoms, orders, and even domains. Bacteriologists have a very difficult job keeping tabs on these chimeras. And when we reach the very edge of life and consider viruses like SARS-CoV-2, responsible for COVID-19, things become even more complicated. Viruses straddle the supposed rigid boundary between living beings and lifeless matter, between biology and chemistry. Unlike bacteria, viruses aren't single-cell organisms. They aren't cells at all, and don't possess any cellular machinery of their own. Viruses don't eat or metabolize, and cannot reproduce by themselves. They are tiny packets of genetic code, which are able to penetrate cells, hijack their cellular machinery, and instruct them to produce more copies of that alien genetic code. The new copies burst out of the cell to infect and hijack more cells, which is how the alien code turns viral. Scientists argue endlessly about whether viruses should count as life forms or whether they fall outside the boundary of life. But this boundary isn't an objective reality. It is an intersubjective convention. Even if biologists reach a consensus that viruses are life forms, it wouldn't change anything about how viruses behave. It will only change how humans think about them. Of course, intersubjective conventions are themselves part of reality. As we humans become more powerful, so our intersubjective beliefs become more consequential for the world outside our information networks. For example, scientists and legislators have categorized species according to the threat of extinction they face on a scale ranging from least concern through vulnerable and endangered to extinct. Defining a particular population of animals as an endangered species is an intersubjective human convention, but it can have far-reaching consequences. For instance, by imposing legal restrictions on hunting those animals or destroying their habitat. A bureaucratic decision about whether a certain animal belongs in the endangered species drawer or in the vulnerable species drawer could make the difference between life and death. As we shall see time and again in subsequent chapters, when a bureaucracy puts a label on you, even though the label might be pure convention, it can still determine your fate. That's true whether the bureaucrat is a flesh and blood expert on animals, a flesh and blood expert on humans, or an inorganic AI. The deep state. In defense of bureaucracy, it should be noted that while it sometimes sacrifices truth and distorts our understanding of the world, it often does so for the sake of order, without which it would be hard to maintain any large-scale human network. While bureaucracies are never perfect, is there a better way to manage big networks? For example, if we decided to abolish all conventional divisions in the academic world, all departments and faculties and specialized journals, would every prospective doctor be expected to devote several years to the study of history? And would people who studied the impact of the Black Death on Christian theology be considered expert virologists? Would it lead to better healthcare systems? Anyone who fantasizes about abolishing all bureaucracies in favor of a more holistic approach to the world should reflect on the fact that hospitals, too, are bureaucratic institutions. They are divided into different departments with hierarchies, protocols, and lots of forms to fill out. They suffer from many bureaucratic illnesses, but they still manage to cure us of many of our biological illnesses. The same goes for almost all the other services that make our life better, from our schools to our sewage system. When you flush the toilet, where does the waste go? It goes into the deep state. There is an intricate subterranean web of pipes, pumps, and tunnels that runs under our houses and collects our waste, separates it from the supply of drinking water, and either treats or safely disposes of it. Somebody needs to design, construct, and maintain that deep web, plug holes in it, monitor pollution levels, and pay the workers. That too is bureaucratic work, and we would face a lot of discomfort and even death if we abolished that particular department. Sewage water and drinking water are always in danger of mixing, but luckily for us, there are bureaucrats who keep them separate. Prior to the establishment of modern sewage systems, waterborne infectious diseases like dysentery and cholera killed millions of people around the world. In 1854, hundreds of London residents began dying of cholera. It was a relatively small outbreak, but it proved to be a turning point in the history of cholera, of epidemics more generally, and of sewage. The leading medical theory of the day argued that cholera epidemics were caused by bad air. But the physician John Snow suspected that the cause was the water supply. He painstakingly tracked and listed all known cholera patients, their place of residence, and their source of water. The resulting data led him to identify the water pump on Broad Street in Soho as the epicenter of the outbreak. This was tedious bureaucratic work, collecting data, categorizing it, and mapping it, but it saved lives. Snow explained his findings to local officials, persuading them to disable the Broad Street pump, which effectively ended the outbreak. Subsequent research discovered that the well providing water to the Broad Street pump was dug less than a meter from a cholera-infected cesspit. Snow's discovery, and the work of many subsequent scientists, engineers, lawyers, and officials, resulted in a sprawling bureaucracy regulating cesspits, water pumps, and sewage lines. In today's England, digging wells and constructing cesspits require filling out forms and getting licenses, which ensure that drinking water doesn't come from a well someone dug next to a cesspit. It is easy to forget about this system when it works well, but since 1854, it has saved millions of lives, and it is one of the most important services provided by modern states. In 2014, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India identified the lack of toilets as one of India's biggest problems. Open defecation is a major cause for spreading diseases like cholera, dysentery, and diarrhea, as well as exposing women and girls to sexual assaults. As part of his flagship Clean India mission, Modi promised to provide all Indian citizens with access to toilets, and between 2014 and 2020, the Indian state invested around $10 billion in the project, building more than 100 million new latrines. Sewage isn't the stuff of epic poems, but it is a test of a well-functioning state. The biological dramas. Mythology and bureaucracy are the twin pillars of every large-scale society. Yet while mythology tends to inspire fascination, bureaucracy tends to inspire suspicion. Despite the services they provide, even beneficial bureaucracies often fail to win the public's trust. For many people, the very word bureaucracy carries negative connotations. This is because it is inherently difficult to know whether a bureaucratic system is beneficial or malicious. For all bureaucracies, good or bad, share one key characteristic. It is hard for humans to understand them. Any kid can tell the difference between a friend and a bully. You know if someone shares their lunch with you or instead takes yours. But when the tax collector comes to take a cut from your earnings, how can you tell whether it goes to build a new public sewage system or a new private dacha for the president? It is hard to get all the relevant information, and even harder to interpret it. It is similarly difficult for citizens to understand the bureaucratic procedures determining how pupils are admitted to schools, how patients are treated in hospitals, or how garbage is collected and recycled. It takes a minute to tweet allegations of bias, fraud, or corruption, and many weeks of arduous work to prove or disprove them. Documents, archives, forms, licenses, regulations, and other bureaucratic procedures have changed the way information flows in society, and with it, the way power works. This made it far more difficult to understand power. What is happening behind the closed doors of offices and archives, where anonymous officials analyze and organize piles of documents and determine our fate with a stroke of a pen or a click of a mouse? In tribal societies that lack written documents and bureaucracies, the human network is composed of only human-to-human and human-to-story chains. Authority belongs to the people who control the junctions that link the various chains. These junctions are the tribe's foundational myths. Charismatic leaders, orators, and mythmakers know how to use these stories in order to shape identities, build alliances, and sway emotions. In human networks connected by written documents and bureaucratic procedures, from ancient Ur to modern India, society relies in part on the interaction between humans and documents. In addition to human-to-human and human-to-story chains, such societies are held together by human-to-document chains. When we observe a bureaucratic society at work, we still see humans telling stories to other humans, as when millions of Indians watched the Ramayana series. But we also see humans passing documents to other humans, as when TV networks are required to apply for broadcasting licenses and fill out tax reports. Looked at from a different perspective, what we see is documents compelling humans to engage with other documents. This led to shifts in authority. As documents became a crucial nexus linking many social chains, considerable power came to be invested in these documents, and experts in the arcane logic of documents emerged as new authority figures. Administrators, accountants, and lawyers mastered not just reading and writing, but also the skills of composing forms, separating drawers, and managing archives. In bureaucratic systems, power often comes from understanding how to manipulate obscure budgetary loopholes and from knowing your way around the labyrinths of offices, committees, and subcommittees. This shift in authority changed the balance of power in the world. For better or worse, literate bureaucracies tended to strengthen the central authority at the expense of ordinary citizens. It's not just that documents and archives made it easier for the center to tax, judge, and conscript everybody. The difficulty of understanding bureaucratic power simultaneously made it harder for the masses to influence, resist, or evade the central authority. Even when bureaucracy was a benign force, providing people with sewage systems, education, and security, it still tended to increase the gap between rulers and ruled. The system enabled the center to collect and record a lot more information about the people it governed, while the latter found it much more difficult to understand how the system itself worked. Art, which helps us understand many other aspects of life, offered only limited assistance in this case. Poets, playwrights, and movie makers have occasionally focused on the dynamics of bureaucratic power. However, this has proven to be a very difficult story to communicate. Artists usually work with a limited set of storylines that are rooted in our biology, but none of these biological dramas sheds much light on the workings of bureaucracy, because they have all been scripted by evolution millions of years before the emergence of documents and archives. To understand what biological dramas are, and why they are a poor guide for understanding bureaucracy, let's consider in detail the plot of one of humanity's greatest artistic masterpieces, the Ramayana. One important plotline in the Ramayana concerns the relations between the eponymous prince Rama, his father, King Dasharatha, and his stepmother, Queen Kaikeyi. Though Rama, being the eldest son, is the rightful heir to the kingdom, Kaikeyi persuades the king to banish Rama to the wilderness.